Can everybody hear me okay? It's all good?
Okay, good. Sometimes I can be a bit quiet, I guess. So what I want to, this talk is going to be about two different stances that you can take up in the philosophy of mathematics. The first stance is sort of well known. It's a position that's been developed by Stephen Yablo in a series of papers since about 1998, and it's called hermeneutic fictionalism. The second kind of stance that we can take up in the philosophy of mathematics is a position which I don't think is very marked, well marked at all in current debates in the philosophy of mathematics. And that's a position that I'm going to be calling pragmatic pluralism, which sort of results from a kind of pragmatist interpretation of Carnap, which is kind of inspired, it's a view that I'm kind of trying to develop, and it's sort of inspired by some of the things Hugh said about Carnap. I don't want to attribute the particular way in which I formulate it to Hugh, it's sort of my own way of cashing it out, so any of the mistakes that I have, don't attribute them to Hugh. There's no real pragmatist account of mathematics on the table, and what I'm hoping to do is sort of show how Yablo has actually done a lot of the work that the pragmatist needs to get done in order to provide an account of mathematics, and that we can sort of turn Yablo's account of, turn Yablo's fictionalist account into a pragmatist account if we deny a few of his claims. And I'm going to suggest that the sort of pragmatic reconstrual of Yablo is going to be more plausible than Yablo's hermeneutic fictionalism. And given that Yablo's view is taken so seriously, this is going to sort of put pragmatism on the table in contemporary meta-ontological debates. So here's an outline of the talk. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to describe both views. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to disentangle Yablo's fictionalist claim from his claim about the expressive function of mathematics. So Yablo makes two claims, one that we should interpret our mathematical discourse as it is, as being put forward in a fictional way, and the other is this interesting sort of claim about the expressive function of mathematical discourse. What's going to become apparent is that pragmatic pluralism is essentially going to adopt the expressive claim, the claim about the expressive function of mathematics, but then in contrast to the fictional claim, it's going to say that once we adopt that kind of functional account of our mathematical language, we're going to be licensed to be able to genuinely make literal ontological assertions, such as denial of fictionalism. So the second stage is sort of going to open up conceptual space for pragmatism. And then I'm going to argue that the pragmatist view is sort of is more plausible than Yablo's view by suggesting that the fictionalist claim is implausible. And I'm going to give three different kinds of arguments to suggest that Yablo's hermeneutic fictionalist part is implausible. And then I'm going to sort of cite some motivations as to why you might think that the functional story is still plausible. And then hopefully I'll get on to a sort of diagnosis of why pragmatism might not have seemed like a live option, especially to someone like Stephen Yablo. I'm going to cite at least one, I might be able to get to two, sort of further arguments that Yablo has for his fictionalist account and show that they sort of implicitly rely on the idea that the only option we have when making literal mathematical claims is to think of them in a kind of robustly metaphysical way, which the pragmatic pluralist is going to try to sidestep. So the upshot is that this opens a new pragmatist understanding of ontological commitment in mathematics, so that's kind of my hope. Okay, so I'll start out by talking about pragmatic pluralism. So pragmatic pluralism begins, I think, with Carnap's original distinction between internal and external ontological questions, and internal and external answers to ontological questions. So internal answers are supposed to be, in some sense, non-metaphysical answers. We're not supposed to be engaging in any controversial metaphysical claims when we make internal claims. And in order to see the difference between internal and external answers to ontological questions, we need to start with Carnap's notion of a linguistic framework. So here's Carnap. He says, if someone wishes to speak in his language about a new kind of entities, he has to introduce a new system of ways of speaking, subject to new rules. We shall call this procedure the construction of a linguistic framework. I think that this reading supports a reading of a linguistic framework that's been given by Eklund recently. And it's a kind of uncontroversial reading of a linguistic framework. All Eklund says that is that linguistic frameworks are to be thought of as nothing more than language fragments, which are certain sets of expressions that are governed by rules of usage. So in this view, linguistic frameworks are just sets of symbols which are given their meaning by being associated with certain rules of use, such that if those symbols didn't have any rules of use associated with them, then those symbols wouldn't have any meaning. So how does that get us to make sort of non-metaphysical ontological claims or internal ontological claims? I think a good way of cashing this out is to take advantage of Thomason's recent notion of an easy argument. So according to Thomason, once we allow that numerical terms like five and the number of and there are to have their ordinary rules of use within mathematical practice, we can build the following easy argument to arrive at what we might have thought was a deep ontological conclusion. And the easy argument would go like this. So I can start out with an uncontroversial claim, at least uncontroversial by the lights of Platonists and nominalists, that there are five ancient Scottish universities. And then, based on the rules of use in the linguistic framework, then I'm allowed to claim the number of ancient Scottish universities is five, and then I'm allowed to conclude that there is a number, the number five, which ontologically commits me to the number five, and so we have an answer to the question of whether or not there are numbers, and we can do this for like all the numbers, and Amy thinks that we can do this for claims about properties and possibilities and other kinds of talk. So why is that conclusion not a sort of metaphysical conclusion? So I think there are two reasons. One is that the easy arguments are too trivial to be considered metaphysical arguments. Metaphysics is supposed to be deep and substantive. It's not just to follow. It's not just supposed to follow trivially from these kinds of considerations. And then the second reason is that the interesting work that's done in the argument comes from considering the rules of use for the relevant terms rather than inquiry into numerical reality. So metaphysicians, I take it, want to keep their eyes firmly set on the world, but here the easy arguments follow by considering how we use mathematical language in practice. They follow from the rules of the linguistic framework. Okay, so there are two different stances then that we can take up sort of external to linguistic framework. So once we have those rules in place, and two different justifications we can give for sort of starting to use that linguistic framework. And I'm going to cash this out as pragmatic versus metaphysical external stances to linguistic framework. So to see this distinction, I'd like to take advantage of a sort of more familiar distinction between practical and theoretical reasons. Consider the following examples. So this is an example of practical reasoning. Imagine my friend Nick needs to get from Edinburgh to Glasgow, and he wants to have an enjoyable ride. He knows that the more scenic route is a little bit longer, and he's wondering whether or not he's got enough time to get to Glasgow by taking the scenic route. And he sort of comes to think that actually he will have enough time if he takes the scenic route, and he wants to enjoy his ride. So he decides that he should take the scenic route. What's important about that example is, and being an instance of practical reasoning, is that Nick is primarily concerned with deciding what to do. Theoretical reasoning is different, so consider Lily, who's in Glasgow, and she's wondering what route Nick will take. So she weighs up considerations like whether or not Nick is perpetually late for things, whether Nick actually enjoys the Scottish landscape, and she comes to think that Nick will actually end up taking the scenic route. Here, Lily's sort of considerations are firmly on the truth of the proposition of whether or not Nick will take the scenic route. So Lily might not have any more goals in her kind of inquiry than considering the truth of the matter. So with respect to linguistic frameworks, we can take up two different kinds of stances. So one is which we look for practical reasons, and we think about whether or not we should adopt a linguistic framework by deciding whether or not we should, I didn't press that red button, but so one stance we can take up is where we are deciding whether or not to use the linguistic framework in the sense of deciding what to do, and we're citing practical reasons. The more metaphysical stance that we can take up, and I take it that this is sort of what metaphysicians are looking for when they're looking for whether or not we should believe in mathematical language, is they're looking for claims about the truth of whether or not there really are mathematical entities, whether there really is a mathematical part of reality. So that's the sort of distinction between pragmatic and metaphysical stances on an external question. And pragmatists are going to claim that the only external stance we should take up is a practical one. Finally, the last part of the pragmatist bit is pluralism. So the idea here is that different frameworks might allow us to do different things. They might allow us to do different to get different jobs done. So I'm going to consider a toy example to kind of elucidate this. So one example of somebody who I think uses takes up a pragmatic external stance in justifying the use of moral language, for example, would be someone like Simon Blackburn, who thinks that, you know, who says that the function of moral language is to allow us to voice our attitudes regarding certain actions and to be able to argue over these actions so that we kind of coordinate our sentiments. Some sort of story along those lines. And then for the sake of argument, we might think that endorsing a talk about electrons might serve to explain and predict our sensory promptings. So those are going to be two different jobs that endorsing a linguistic framework is going to get done for us. And the pragmatic, the pluralist point is just that the pragmatist is happy to say that you know, both practical reasons are valid, and we shouldn't be taking one kind of goal as being our only practical sort of the criterion for deciding on whether or not we should start to use a framework. Okay, so now on to hermeneutic fictionalism. So hermeneutic fictionalism consists of two claims. First claim I'm going to call fun, because it's fun, and it also stands for function. It's a functional claim. So the so Yablo's functional claim is that we need to enlist mathematical discourse as a means of expressing certain claims that we could not otherwise express. I'm going to cast that out in a moment. And then he's got a fictional claim as well, which claims that mathematical discourse is best characterized or represented as, or interpreted as being fictional. A little note on the fictional claim. So Yablo counts as what's called a hermeneutic fictionalist in the sense that he thinks that when we make mathematical claims in ordinary discourse, the best interpretation of our ordinary claims is as putting them forward in a sort of fictional vein. And this is in contrast to people like Hartree Field, for example, who are called revolutionary fictionalists. So Field thinks we have good independent reasons to think that all of our mathematical claims are false, but because mathematics is useful, we should we can talk about, we can quantify over numbers in a fictional vein if we want to. Okay. So to elucidate the functional claim, I'm going to start with two examples. So so consider a sentence like, the number of cats in the world is greater than the number of dogs. So you might ask, what does making that claim allow us to do? Well, according to Yablo, the practical function of making claims like that, in which we use number terms, is to be able to express, or is to be able to indirectly express an infinite disjunction, namely that there are either zero dogs and one cat, or zero dogs and two cats, or one dog and three cats. So in this way, the idea is that when we make mathematical claims, the primary reason why it's good for us and useful for us to make these mathematical claims is that given that we're finite creatures, and so we can't like write out or assert uncountably many sentences, we can, instead of sort of writing out the infinite disjunction, we can simply say the claim, the number of cats in the world is greater than the number of dogs, and so be able to express in a finite way a certain infinite number of facts. And Yablo thinks that this also works in, this is how numbers sort of function in scientific laws. So, for example, Yablo considers a case in which a physicist who's studying escape velocity wants to formulate a statement about escape velocity that covers an infinity of facts about the trajectories of objects in a particular gravitational field. And he says, to do this, we quantify over numbers and say that for all positive real numbers m and r, the escape velocity from a sphere of mass m and a diameter 2r is the square root of 2gm over r, where g is the gravitational constant. Now, I don't expect people to like fully sort of understand that, but the important point is that the way those number terms work in the formulation of scientific laws, according to Yablo, is similar to the claim about cats and dogs. Employing number terms allows us to do is to be able to express claims that we could not as finite creatures otherwise express, for that would require asserting uncountably many sentences. So that's sort of Yablo's, in a nutshell, sort of Yablo's practical account of the function of mathematical discourse. But then Yablo thinks that given the practical function of mathematical discourse, number talk seems to look analogous to what he calls, and Kendall Walton calls, prop-oriented make-believe. And so the idea here is that certain kinds of make-believe can be employed to indirectly make serious claims about the world. And this is supposed to, and so the idea is that make-believe can work in an analogous way to the way mathematics works, given the expressive function of mathematics, by allowing us to indirectly make claims about cats and dogs, for example. So that's going to be one of the primary motivations for Iablo in saying that mathematical discourse is best characterized or interpreted as fictional. So to elucidate that kind of claim, I'm going to introduce you to the game of mud pies. Okay, so the game of mud pies consists of two rules, F1 and F2. So F1 is that globs of mud count as pies. F2 is that red crates count as an oven. So in this game, what we do is we put globs of mud into red crates, and then we're licensed according to the rules of the make-believe game to say that I put a pie in the oven. So in this way, so the idea here is that the make-believe game allows us to indirectly make serious claims about the world, like there is a glob of mud, by using make-believe claim like there is a pie. So in this way, Iablo contends that in some cases, make-believe games can allow for, rather than undermine, the expression of facts about the concrete world. And the fact that certain make-believe games can allow for the indirect expression of worldly facts is, according to Iablo, going to be exactly what we're doing when we employ number talk to serve its expressive role. So in the same way that saying the pie was put in the oven can indirectly allow me to make a claim about globs of mud going into red crates, so too Iablo suggests that number talk, while completely make-believe, can allow us to express facts about concrete reality. So the particular type of make-believe here, as I said, is prop-oriented make-believe, and on this view, the props, which would be like the globs of mud and the red crates, may generate make-believe truths like there is a pie in the oven. And so likewise, Iablo claims that the governing fiction generative principle of applied arithmetic says that whenever there is some e's, there is an entity, their number, that measures them cardinality-wise. If there are five e's, this further entity is five. So, for example, so the idea is that if we look back to the easy argument I gave, which, according to the pragmatic pluralist, is just, you know, a genuine, literal, sort of internal inference, set of inferences that we can make to a literal ontological conclusion, within mathematical discourse, Iablo thinks that instead, what we're doing is, when we make those kinds of claims are going to be analogous to the make-believe, like the game of mud pies. So we can make, so we are sort of using Scottish universities here as props, and so we say there are five ancient Scottish universities, and then based on the rules of the make-believe game of mathematics, what I can do is I can then say the number of ancient Scottish universities is five, and say that therefore the number there is a number, namely the number five. Okay. So that's pragmatic pluralism and hermeneutic fictionalism. So now I want to say something about the relationship between pragmatic pluralism and hermeneutic fictionalism. So notice that the functional claim is going to be just the kind of practical story that the pragmatist thinks we should be telling instead of doing metaphysics. So what Iablo is doing when he's telling you about the expressive function of mathematics is effectively taking up a practical stance, a pragmatic stance, in contrast to a metaphysical stance external to the linguistic framework of mathematics. So in other words, it provides a pragmatic justification for adopting a way of talking in which we quantify over numbers. It asks us, you know, it asks why would creatures like us find it useful to talk about numbers, and it gives a nice answer based on practical reasons and our practical needs as finite creatures. The only difference between pragmatism and fictionalism would seem to be the fictionalism. So as I said before, while the pragmatist thinks that once you tell that pragmatic story, you're then licensed to sort of go in for the linguistic framework of mathematics and then trivially conclude claims like there are numbers. And, you know, for the pragmatist, that's going to be fully literal. That's the kind of a kind of ontological commitment that the pragmatist has in play. Iablo thinks, in contrast, that the functional story actually ends up vindicating the idea that those internal claims are merely made in a fiction or a pretense. So the idea is that if we have reason to... So pragmatism is just Iablo minus the fictional claim. So if we have reasons to deny the fictional claim and instead claim that our commitments are genuine, or literal, then we'll be pushed in the direction of pragmatism about mathematics, provided, of course, we think that the functional stories are the functional story is still a good story to tell about mathematical language. So my strategy here is going to be to make an analogy with. So what I want to do is I want to show, first of all, that there's conceptual space for pragmatism by arguing that it's not obvious that the functional claim entails the fictional claim. And I want to do this by making an analogy with minimalism about truth. Minimalists about truth have a similar sort of expressive story to tell about the truth predicate, but they don't typically claim that our claims involving truth should be interpreted as fictional. So what's minimalism about truth? Well, according to Horich, it consists of two claims, broadly speaking. So first, we give an account of how we use the truth predicate, what it takes to correctly use a predicate like is true. And Horich thinks that that's going to be given by the T schema, namely that P is true if and only if P. So you count as knowing how to use the truth predicate just in case you're willing to assent to claims of the form snow is white is true just in case snow is white, and grass is green is true just in case grass is green, and on and on and on. But then minimalists take up what I've been calling a sort of pragmatic stance on that bit of language. And they ask, well, why would creatures like us find it useful to have a predicate like that in our discourse? And the answer minimalists give is very similar to the answer that Yablo gives. So the idea is that the truth predicate can give us certain kinds of expressive resources. So for example, say that I'm convinced that everything Carnap said is true, but I don't know everything that Carnap said. So even though I can't write out or assert each particular sentence or claim that Carnap made, I can sort of endorse everything that Carnap said by saying something like, everything Carnap says is true. Likewise, say I wanted to endorse an infinity of claims of the form P or not P, I could endorse that infinite number of claims in a finite fashion by simply saying that all propositions of the form P or not P are true. So in this way, the expressive function of truth is roughly analogous to Yablo's expressive story about mathematics. It allows us to, in a finite way, indirectly make claims that we couldn't make because that would require either writing out uncountably many sentences or sort of writing out sentences of which we're ignorant of. But minimalists don't typically take that kind of expressive story to vindicate the idea that our claims involving truth are fictional. So here's Horich on that. He says, it's not part of the minimalist conception to maintain that truth is not a property. On the contrary, is true is a perfectly good English predicate. Concerns about the very notion, and one might think that this might well be some sort of be a conclusive criterion for standing for a property of some sort. What the minimalist wishes to emphasize, however, is that truth is not a complex or naturalistic property, but a property of some other kind. The point behind this jargon is that different kinds of property correspond to different roles that predicates play in our language. And unless these differences are appreciated, we will be tempted to raise questions regarding one sort that can legitimately arise only in connection with another sort. So this last bit of the passage, I think, mirrors the pragmatic pluralist sentiments exactly. The idea is that we introduce different parts of our language for different practical purposes. Truth, it just so happens, was introduced to fulfill a particular kind of expressive need, and in virtue of its expressive function, we shouldn't be led to reject the thought that there genuinely is a property of truth just because it couldn't be a complex or a kind of naturalistic property. So you might think that the same thing should hold for in the philosophy of mathematics. Just because mathematics might serve a sort of expressive role doesn't mean that numbers aren't objects, or that we shouldn't be genuinely quantifying over numbers. Anyway, so I just make that parallel to sort of say that there's at least say that given that a number of philosophers think that it's true that you can have an expressive a discourse can serve a sort of expressive function, and nevertheless not be associated with any kind of pretense or fictional claims. So too, you might think that pragmatism, which is just the endorsement of the expressive claim about mathematics, without the fictionalist writers, is at least a conceptual possibility. So it might, I mean, Yablo's, this isn't meant to undermine Yablo's arguments from before, it's just meant to sort of signal a conceptual possibility here. Yablo's arguments might still invite that interpretation, but now I've got three arguments against Yablo's fictional interpretation. So the first argument I'm going to be calling the phenomenological disanalogy. So all these arguments point to disanalogies between mathematical language and make-believe language. And so I'm hoping that these three disanalogies are going to outweigh the sort of evidence that Yablo gives to make an analogy between mathematics and fiction. So the first claim is the phenomenological disanalogy. So consider your belief that 2 plus 2 equals 4, or that there's a number between 6 and 8. When we make mathematical claims, we certainly don't feel that we're engaged in any kind of make-believe. In the case of mathematics, we're prone to agree with Kit Fine here, who says that in claiming that there is a prime number between 8 and 12, I would appear to have as good a case of strict and literal truth as one could hope to have. If these are not strict and literal truths, then one is left with no idea either of what a strict and literal truth is or of what the strict and literal content of these claims might be. So the idea here is that unlike the case of mud pies that I gave, when we're engaged in the game of mud pies, we know, we're pretty well aware, we have a kind of phenomenological feeling that we're engaged in a fiction, we're not sort of, you know, talking in a way that we're really committed to. And so that provides a disanalogy between mathematical discourse and make-believe discourse. In order to avoid this objection, the hermeneutic fictionalist is going to have to tell an adequate story about how we could come to engage in a practice of make-believe without explicitly being aware of it. And you might be able to tell such a story, but I think that the problem with such a story is that the analogical evidence the hermeneutic fictionalist offers for make-believe interpretation of mathematics is going to be weaker than the phenomenological evidence that seems to provide a disanalogy. So above it was remarked that serving an expressive function does not obviously mean that the expressive discourse is make-believe. That was the claim about in which I used minimalism as an example. But it certainly does seem obvious to most people that our mathematical claims are not mere pretending. Okay, so I'll go on to the next one. So if that doesn't convince you, then here's another argument. This is kind of an argument that Amy Thomason's recently given against Yablo's program. And I'm going to call it the linguistic disanalogy. So notice that for any relevant, it would seem that for any relevant make-believe game, we're going to have certain kinds of rules in play in which there's a sort of systematic misapplication of our terms going on. So in normal circumstances, pie and oven have conditions of application that are not properly used to apply to globs of mud and orange crates. So, you know, our rules of use for terms like pie and oven are going to be different than they in normal cases than they are in the game of mud pies. You know, so I'll, you know, claim that that's a pie when I see like a fruity pastry or whatever, rather than a glob of mud. But this kind of error in application conditions or the rules of use for our terms doesn't seem to hold for mathematical talk and truth talk, for example. So in order to fulfill, so I'll start with truth talk because I think it's like a little bit easier to see. So in order to fulfill the expressive purpose of employing truth talk, all we need are, all we need is application conditions like P is true just in, being able to say that P is true just in case P. And what more could it take to accurately apply the truth predicate than being committed to something like a T-scheme? It seems like, in the case of truth, it's redundant to say snow is white, oh, and snow is white is true. Likewise, so Yablo wants there to be a clear contrast between the make-believe commitments of the claim that the number of ancient Scottish universities is 5, and then the serious content that there are 5 ancient Scottish universities. But likewise, it would seem that this contrast is just as blurred as it is in the case of truth, in light of the fact that when I say there are five ancient Scottish universities and the number of ancient Scottish universities is five, that seems redundant in English. It doesn't seem like, so in other words, there doesn't really seem to be any space to warrant the idea that we're somehow misapplying our terms. And so that's, so we can make sense of the idea that we're misapplying our terms in the mud pie case, but we can't make sense of that we're misapplying our terms in the number case, and then, so that's another kind of disanalogy. Okay. Finally, I just want to note an empirical disanalogy, if none of those other disanalogies convince you. So I thought this was quite interesting. Stanley argues that autistic children systematically have problems understanding fiction. And so if you put an autistic kid, if you try to teach an autistic kid the game of mud pies, presumably they'd have a very hard time understanding what was going on because they have problems understanding fiction. So you might think that if mathematics was fictional all along, we would expect autistic children to have problems understanding mathematics. But in fact, we don't. They don't have any problems understanding mathematics. They tend to be quite good at it. So that's another disanalogy at the empirical level. So the sort of point to take home is that Diablo offers an analogy between the way expressive discourses function and make-believe games. It's not obvious that the expressive function of that just because a discourse serves an expressive function, it should be interpreted as fictional. And moreover, there's a lot more disanalogies going on in the case of mathematics and make believe than there are analogies. So we should scrap the fictional interpretation. Okay, now I want to say some things about why we should endorse the functional claim. So, here I don't want to sort of say that the functional claim is going to be something, I don't want to kind of convince everybody definitively that the functional claim is a good one. I just want to show some motivations that you might have, independent of any of Diablo's fictionalist claims, for endorsing the functional claim, and for at least those who are kind of like into these kinds of stories, endorsing the functional claim will give us a number of advantages. And the point is that the pragmatic pluralist can sort of reap the benefits of these advantages by just saying that, well, what the functional claim does is it gives us pragmatic reasons to endorse the linguistic framework. Without having to deal with any of the problematic fictional considerations. So the first advantage that pragmatism, that the functional claim has, is that it provides a plausible answer to what I'll call a genealogical question. Why did we start talking in mathematical ways in the first place? And I think that any kind of account of the philosophy of mathematics, I mean, usually this isn't a question that crops up so much. I mean, it crops up on the sort of more anti-realist side of the debate sometimes when you're trying to explain, well, if I'm not committed to mathematics being true, then why would we make these claims? And then you tell a useful story. But everybody's got to have some sort of nice, Platonists included, have to have some sort of nice answer to this, because if we want to understand, give a full understanding of mathematical discourse. And the functional story gives us a nice understanding of this, which doesn't cite anything sort of spooky. It doesn't The story can be thought of as naturalistic. We start out by noting that us language users are finite creatures. We can't. It's simply an empirical fact that we can't make an infinite number of claims in one go. And then we cite our different practical projects that we want to get done, and we're able to then show on that sort of slender basis why we got into the game of talking in mathematical ways. So you might find that to be a kind of motivation for endorsing the functional claim. Second, the functional claim gives us an account of the applicability of mathematics directly by saying that mathematics starts with our need to make generalizations about physical objects. So everybody in the philosophy of mathematics is going to have to account for why mathematics is applicable to the physical world. And the nice thing about Diablo's functional story is that it starts out with our with us making claims like, you know, there are five ancient Scottish universities, and then sort of saying why we would need number talk in order to get a certain expressive job done with respect to those concrete entities. So it seems to sort of give a nice account of the applicability of mathematics. Before I mentioned as well that Yablo thinks that you know, mathematics plays this expressive function in the sciences by being able to better formulate certain kinds of laws. So the functional claim also shows us the particular way in which in which mathematics can be seen as indispensable to our scientific theories as scientists formulate them. So as we have current science, science makes a ton of claims using mathematics. You know, this sort of cries out for an explanation, and Yablo is giving an explanation by citing the expressive function of mathematical discourse. Finally, it would seem that if we didn't want to do any of this by giving an expressive story about the function of mathematical discourse, then the natural alternative would seem to be to offer a story in which the function of mathematical talk is instead explanatory. Mathematical talk would then seem to work in a similar way to our talk about electrons and the like, which are typically taken as explanatory posits, providing an explanation for our sensory promptings and explanation of why our predictions are so successful. But the sort of problem with this strategy is that we would need to specify the notion of explanation in play here, and note that it cannot be causal explanation. For numbers, unlike electrons and other physical objects, are paradigmatic examples of objects which have causal powers. We might, following, I think Kurt Gödel sort of thought this, was that, so Gödel apparently made an analogy between talking about physical objects and talk about numbers by saying that what numbers do is they play an explanatory role in explaining our mathematical intuitions. But the problem with these kinds of claims is first that it's generally been thought that you know, it's difficult to provide a nice account of what intuitions are. And second, that those stories often start to not chime sort of well with sort of naturalistic, you know, seeing how, you know, well, how exactly could we have intuitions about abstract objects given that we're natural creatures? It's just very hard to sort of tell that sort of story. And Yablo's expressive story would seem to sidestep all those worries. So again, I don't think that these considerations are definitive reasons to endorse the functional claim. These arguments will need to be spelled out more carefully against the backdrop of explanations that Platonists might give, for example. But the important point I want to make here is simply that that pragmatic pluralism is a more plausible route than fictionalism in understanding mathematical discourse, because it doesn't have to deal with the problems that I cited for the fictional interpretation. But nevertheless, it can reap all the other benefits of the hermeneutic fictionalist, and so it does seem to be that pragmatic pluralism is kind of winning here. And so that's sort of motivation to say that, you know, pragmatic pluralism, given that Yablo's position is taken seriously, we should start to take pragmatic pluralism seriously. Okay, now I'm going to the last bit. I think I've got... Cool. So I'll just, I've got two of these examples. I'll go with the kind of easier one. So Yablo's arguments don't all trade on analogies between fiction and make-believe games. He's got some other reasons for being a hermeneutic fictionalist. One is by considering what he calls the paradox of existence. So the paradox of existence is this: that the existence of abstract objects strikes most of us as an enduringly controversial matter, but at the same time, the existence of abstract objects is straightforwardly deducible from premises that few would think to deny using simple bridge principles widely accepted on the basis of non-empirical evidence. Yablo's solution, then, is to account for this paradox, is to say that, well, first of all, notice that the second bit of that claim, so the idea that abstract objects are straightforwardly deducible from premises few would think to deny using simple bridge principles, is essentially, he's just citing what I was calling the kinds of easy arguments that we get for the existence of mathematical entities based on the rules of use of our discourse. So Yablo's idea here, his solution, is to say that the trivial arguments are valid within the rules of the fiction, whereas the real existence of numbers should then be decided on more substantive metaphysical grounds. So the idea here is that, well, the philosophers have been getting things pretty much right in terms of, at least when they're sort of doing metaphysics and thinking about the real existence of numbers, those kinds of trivial considerations don't, in fact, allow us to genuinely conclude that there are numbers. And so so this is one argument for going in for hermeneutic fictionalism, is it's able to sort of make sense of this kind of paradox, seeming paradox. But I think it should be clear that the pragmatist has a solution to this as well. So notice that the trivial arguments are valid once we have accepted the rules of use of mathematical language on pragmatic grounds. So we could. So I'm using now the distinction that I made earlier between pragmatic and metaphysical stances that we can take on a linguistic framework. And then all we need to do in order to make sense of the paradox is just to say that many philosophers think that the existence of abstract objects is controversial because they're looking for further theoretical answers external to the framework of mathematics. Now, of course, the pragmatic pluralist is going to try to suggest against these kinds of philosophers that we don't really need those kinds of theoretical, extra theoretical answers. The trivial arguments we get resulting from a pragmatic adoption of the linguistic of the framework of mathematics is going to be good enough. But the sort of important point here is that Yablo's sort of solution to the paradox completely sidesteps the distinction between pragmatic and metaphysical accounts of ontological commitment to numbers. And in doing so, I think that's kind of evidence for one of the reasons why you might think that why pragmatism has been so hard to see, in particular for philosophers like Yablo, is that Yablo is sort of implicitly sort of assuming that the only kind of literal account that we can take on the existence of numbers is one in which we're engaging in metaphysical inquiry, and so they sort of completely ignore the pragmatic group. Okay, then I'm just going to end here. So I hope what I've done is I've sort of opened up the way for a new pragmatist understanding of our commitment to numbers. I think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to fill out the sort of details of this program. So for example, it's contingent on the sort of functional claim being true. There are reasons that I didn't cite. So for example, some people think that mathematics actually does play an explanatory function in science, and we're going to have to sort of tussle through those kinds of debates. But hopefully, I've sort of laid a new idea out on the table, and given that genuine ontological commitment to numbers has always been sort of associated with the mysteriousness of Platonism, I think that the demystifying effects of pragmatism in this area could prove to be especially fruitful. So we should take pragmatic pluralism as a serious kind of view in the philosophy of mathematics. Thanks.